This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we just recently observed World No Tobacco Day. It's a global event launched by the World Health Organization to examine the impact tobacco is having on global health as well as the global economy. While it's certainly seen a decline in this country, smoking is on the rise in other parts of the world.
Well, the numbers do tell the story on this important health topic, Mark. Smoking is directly linked to some 7 million deaths per year globally. And if smoking and tobacco consumption continue at this rate, the number will be 8 million global deaths by 2030.
While smoking rates in this country have dropped significantly in the past couple of decades, one-fifth of deaths are attributed to smoking or exposure to secondhand smoke. An estimated 450,000 deaths per year in the United States. The World Health Organization is calling for a collective global action to curb the spread of tobacco, which is heavily marketed to vulnerable populations.
Well, there's an economic toll as well, Mark. The World Health Organization estimates $1.3 trillion in productivity lost from smoking-related health costs, as well as lost productivity due to sickness and absenteeism. It's exacting a huge toll on developing economies and adding hundreds of billions of dollars to healthcare costs all the way around. Terrible.
And there are some public interventions that seem to be working. Public smoking bans, higher taxes on tobacco products are helping to curb the problem, but a much larger global effort is needed. And speaking of health costs, Margaret, it's all at the center of health policy discussions underway in Washington.
The Senate is now grappling with the GOP health reform measure passed in the House to replace Obamacare. The American Health Care Act has taken a lot of heat from entities across the healthcare spectrum, and that is something our guest today has spent much of his career focused on.
Thomas Miller, a senior fellow at the Conservative American Heritage Institute, has done much research on market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. He has some insights into what may happen with the Senate's iteration of the GOP health reform bill. It'll be interesting to hear what he has to say about some of those market-driven alternatives to the Affordable Care Act.
And Lori Robertson stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Thomas Miller in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. July at the latest. That's the timeline some Senate Republican insiders are putting on producing a replacement to the House GOP's American Health Care Act on the books. Back from Memorial Day recess, many, including GOP leadership, went home over the holiday to some vociferous opposition to their plans to repeal and replace Obamacare. Growing contingents within the GOP majority say they will not put their stamp on a bill that kicks tens of millions of Americans off their health insurance, as the Congressional Budget Office estimates might happen. With no apparent health care deal in immediate sight, some in the Senate are looking at ways they might be able to make short-term solutions and improvements to the law to bolster the unstable insurance marketplaces. Opioid death rates appear to have skyrocketed in 2016, with some early statistics revealing death rates above the 50,000 mark last year. As the epidemic continues to unfold, some state and local governments are taking their own action. Ohio, a hotspot for opioid overdoses, has become the largest state to sue Purdue Pharma, Johnson & Johnson's Janssen Pharmaceuticals Unit, Endo International, Teva Pharmaceutical, and Allergan. The lawsuit seeks to recover money the state and residents spent on unnecessary opioid prescriptions, as well as costs associated with addiction treatment. The five companies are denying allegations. The White House is following through on a promise to roll back birth control coverage requirements in the Affordable Care Act under certain circumstances. Federal officials drafting a rule that would roll back the requirement that religious organizations must comply with a mandatory birth control coverage. The proposed rule could take effect immediately as an interim final rule. The typical process, however, is to open the rule to public comments before a final decision is made. It's being called a first in clinical cancer trials, an experimental gene therapy therapy for patients with advanced multiple myeloma, a particular kind of blood cancer that is on the rise. Shows all participants in a study showed noted improvement after the experimental treatment, though the sample was relatively small, just 35 patients. Every single one responded favorably to the treatment, and all but two were in remission within 2 months. Experts say it's a first for multiple myeloma and rare for any cancer treatment to have such early success. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Thomas P. Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies health policy and market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Miller is a former senior health economist for the Joint Economic Committee in Congress, where his focus was private health markets, health information transparency, and market-driven healthcare. Also served on the National Advisory Council at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and as a program director of the Economic Policy Studies at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He earned his BA in political science from NYU, his JD from Duke University School of Law. Tom, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Pleasure to be with you.
You know, you've been a vocal critic of the Affordable Care Act and pretty much from its inception, but you also warned opponents of the ACA to get to work on replacement. And here we are 4 years later, watching the GOP replacement for Obamacare, the American Health Care Act, take shape. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what you think the current version of the law and how you think the Senate might improve upon it and what's really going to happen and is going on behind the scenes.
Well, the Affordable Care Act put in place a set of benefits to people and don't want to let go of them. The AHCA is a reaction to that overreach. Now, the problem with moving from criticizing what's in place to replacing it has begun to confront the difficulties of Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been a little surprised at the majorities they got after the November 2016 elections, including the White House. And, you know, the old saying in professional sports is you play like you practice. They didn't practice enough, and so they weren't ready on day one to have a fully fleshed out legislative vehicle that would work, not only delivering votes, but also appealing to the American public. So there's been a turnaround in attitudes where people are reacting more to what they're concerned about, disrupting what they already know. And the unknowns ahead of this various types of replacement legislation. Moving over to the Senate after some of the difficulties in the House involves changing what was done in the House to some degree, reacting to those cross pressures and stresses, mostly reactions of senators to make the rollbacks in the Medicaid expansion coverage less immediate, less onerous. There's also a reaction that moving to the type of subsidies the Republicans have advocated for health insurance, moving them from being so income sensitive to being a little bit flatter with some age adjustments, may be too much of a stretch too quickly. So they may have to make subsidies a little more generous to older Americans, a little below 65, as well as they've already made some tweaks to make them more appealing to young Americans. And then there's just the normal problems of working through what's called budget reconciliation, which allows you to do some things but not everything, and be able to massage that so you can still hold a majority together to pass this law and readjust it. And it's difficult for the Senate to figure out where they're going to get 50 Republican votes plus the vice president, but that's what they're committed to as they stare into the deep, dark abyss of the alternative being total failure.
Well, Tom, we've had a number of guests on the show recently who've shared their thoughts about how best to retool American healthcare and American health reform specifically with a more market-based and consumer-driven focus. I think we've had Mark McClellan and Gail Walensky and Lanhee Chen in the not-distant past. We'd really love for you to share with us what you see as the essential hallmarks of this approach, the market-based, consumer-driven focus, essential hallmarks of this approach to health reform, and importantly, how do you think this will lead to what Americans say they really want, which is improved access, good outcomes, and reining in the high cost of healthcare?
Sure. We need to readjust our rhetoric and what we promise on consumer-driven care to what we can actually put in place. The primary components, though, you have to change the incentive structure so that people are rewarded for making better decisions and have a few negative incentives if they make the wrong ones. And that works on both the provider side, the payer side, and the patient side. And that means a type of bilateral accountability. It's not a one-way directional, but you're responsible for the decisions and choices you make. and that works on both sides. And the consumer part really means that you're more engaged in your care. We found out that people who actually are more involved in decision making are not only better patients but end up with better health. On the other hand, if you just treat them as objects for billing, and they tend not to kind of follow up on things they need to do when they're not in the physician's office. You need to also unbundle a lot of our complex integrated benefits that are supposedly one size fits all and serves everyone, but don't actually match the needs and the preferences and the uniquenesses. We learn more about how all patients are very different. You're going to have to acknowledge that it just can't be that similar one size fits all. Safety nets are going to matter, though. If you're going to turn people loose to make more decisions, not everyone is going to want to do that. But also, a lot of people will fall through the cracks and need special help. And if you don't invest there, you don't have the political support or the credibility. But the language here gets a little overstated. You know, saying everybody is going to have the most wonderful care possible at the lowest cost overstates it. What we can try to credibly promise is that people can improve their situation if they're willing to make some decisions and take some choices on their own. You can't promise the best to everyone at all times with no cost whatsoever. That's simply a political exercise which defies the reality of what actually happens. Sometimes this consumer-driven rhetoric tends to be reduced to efforts through various financial means to suppress demand, and that's not what you want to accomplish. You want to try to have people, for however much they want to spend of their own money as well as what they can get from other people, to maximize their value.
You know, it's not a muscle that Americans have exercised much in this sort of very complex, disjointed American health system. It doesn't seem to operate like the auto industry, and where consumers are really price sensitive. And you know, when you go into the emergency room, there's a real lack of transparency about what the price is. And I'm wondering what your how getting to a market driven health system is going to work through the issues of this institutional resistance to get information about pricing out there. What's your sense of how that's going to work in your ideal vision?
Well, we all resist accountability and transparency if we're on the other end of it. And certainly, although there have been little efforts to try to have, you know, the equivalent of menu boards of the itemized prices, that doesn't mean much to people in terms of the decisions they need to make. You want to know, what are my all-in costs going to be when I go to start over here, but what's my diagnosis and what's it going to produce when everybody throws the bills down in the multiple stages of care? That's a harder type of episode-based cost approximation, which will vary among different people, but you can begin to develop some averages, and insurers have some tools to do that. Certainly, there are extreme circumstances where you're totally unconscious and you're not about to be an active decision maker. You can plan for a whole lot more. I mean, you know right away in terms of the insurance that you choose. If you pay more attention to it, you might know, although they'll change it on you a little bit, who's in your provider directory and what you know about what that plan offers in, as a general rule. Beyond that, though, you have to pre-plan this a little bit. If you invest a little bit more, you might know that some doctors are better at some things than other things, and that it matters as to who your primary care doctor is. And but those are real decisions. Also, people are not usually in, you know, life or death instantaneous situations. Even people with chronic illnesses become much more knowledgeable about their health condition and their care, sometimes in the single specialist who happens to be dealing with them on an isolated basis. So we need to deepen the channels through which people can find out more about what matters to them and be able to make better, more meaningful choices along the way. We need to invest more in that. So the more that we get people having more interest in their health, how they can invest in improving it in ways beyond just the conventional measures, I think that all that would improve what would be a true market-driven approach. We need to improve both the demand side and the supply side of this information so that both the providers wanting to know they're doing better as well as those who are giving them their business can act accordingly.
Tom, you wrote recently that in addition to the rollback of government regulations, getting rid of the individual mandate requiring the purchase of insurance, whatever version of the new health care or Trump care, if you want to call it that, we end up with needs to significantly slow the growth of Medicaid moving forward. And certainly that advice would seem to have been heeded in the ACHA, which makes dramatic cuts to Medicaid, as does the president's budget. But I'd ask you, both on the Medicaid side and also the older, sicker patient with pre-existing conditions, what is the nature of the safety net that catches these people? And you reference the safety net in some of your earlier comments. And, you know, we certainly think of the safety net in terms of community health centers, which is the system of care that we're so familiar with. Certainly the what we used to think of as the disproportionate share hospitals, although I'm not sure anyone calls them that anymore. There's certainly been some shrinking of the public hospitals. But what does that safety net look like if Medicaid is significantly reduced and if the patients with pre-existing conditions that face the premiums and can't make it choose to go uninsured? What does that system look like?
Sure. We need to think about a little bit more nuanced, multi-layered safety net. The efforts to try to trim or readjust or retarget, is the way I would put it, the Medicaid expansion, is that our budgetary problems with Medicaid are not on the per capita cost side, although some people focus upon that with various indexing provisions. We've simply put the Medicaid program on steroids, and so the real expense drivers have been the substantial enrollment growth. And some of this is just political expediency. It's easier to bag and tag people who are relatively lower income and say, Medicaid's good enough for you, go away, and look how many people we've covered, without looking at the quality of coverage that's being provided. The other nuanced distinction we need to get into is on the safety net, there are really kind of two types of populations. We sometimes blur them together. There are individuals who have short-term financial emergencies or lower income in general, and they may need some ways to get out of that low-income problem. That isn't necessarily a healthcare problem as much as it is a welfare-slash-economic-growth social mobility problem. On the other hand, when we overinvest in that side of the safety net, such as through the Medicaid expansion, we tend to give shorter shrift to the people who have much more serious longer-term illnesses or disabilities and don't treat them as well. So we need to invest more in the people who truly can help themselves on a longer-term basis and do a better job of managing that care while trying to mainstream the other low-income population into better jobs, better families, and more self-sufficiency, as opposed to making their status on a longer-term basis. Doesn't mean that there aren't some immediate near-term needs. We have to be more creative about how that care is delivered. You mentioned community health centers. We tend to do a much better job for the dollar because they tend to be more accessible, less complex, less expensive as a general rule, but can actually deliver the care that people need in many of those circumstances. In addition, though, there are just the many other ways in which we can improve the health, not the health care, of the vulnerable population, the low-income population, and that may involve ways in which by investing earlier in their lives, giving them the tools to build the skills they need, the educational factors, the family development social factors, that they won't have those type of problems they're going to face, or they can better manage their lives in the health care and economic system. So if we could invest earlier in delaying the onset of these chronic conditions, there's plenty of research on that front. It's sometimes wrapped up in the idea of social determinants of health, which can be exaggerated because you don't want to micromanage the whole society from infancy. We can actually get better health over a longer period of time and make our expensive system have fewer customers coming into it, at least at an earlier stage.
We're speaking today with Thomas P. Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies health policy and market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. And Tom, you know, I'd like to take a look at the national discussion that's going around health reform now. And I was looking at the Kaiser Family Foundation's recent polls. I'm not sure I can believe polls anymore. I think the Mark Twain adage that there are three types of lies, damn lies, and statistics might apply to polls as well.
And some are statistically adjusted.
But you know what? What we're seeing now is a deeply divided public perception about the bill that came out of the House. You know, we've talked about this a little earlier, but I'm wondering how the Senate sort of builds public trust, or what's your view of the polling data right now, which did show when the Affordable Care Act was not liked, but again, it's showing that they've got off to a bad start. And so what's your thought about the reform discussions that need to move forward, and how do you think they'll be able to close that divide in terms of public perception?
Well, we've had a big turnaround from the polling you would have seen late last year, even right at the fall time of the elections to beginning in January. And it's a serious case of risk aversion and changing the narrative so people reacted to what seemed to be the latest thing to worry about. There were some overpromises as well, or contradictory promises that came out more from President Trump, which is, you know, people say things and they then can't back them up, I suppose. I think it's hard to regenerate some type of even non-extreme bipartisan comity. We've just got a long history as to where we've been on health care, and you're not going to put that egg back together, at least in the short term. That's why the Republicans are going it alone in the same way that the Democrats went it alone. And that's just the underlying political reality. With the narrow margins they have, it also means they go through some contorted exercises to use the tools they have to deliver something, although they didn't know what that was going to be. Looking ahead, I suppose if this particular exercise doesn't meet with some intermediate level of finality and passage of a law, we're likely to see some desperate moves later on toward the end of this year, early next year, to move more toward a broader short-term set of intermediate fixes and rescue efforts, particularly if some of these markets begin melting down. That's just bailing water out of the boat, but we will eventually go through that exercise if necessary. I'd like to be more optimistic on this front, but I tend to adopt the perspective of Miracle Max in The Princess Bride. I've seen worse, but it's mostly dead.
Well, I'm going to give you a chance to be a little bit optimistic, perhaps, because one of the tenets we live by is we should always be looking around the country to see who's doing innovative work, who's not just had a good idea, but is implementing it, innovating, and has some results to show for it. So when you look around the country, what states do you see that have really made some positive strides in health reform? We'd love to hear your take on that.
Look, states have been, their things happen to small degrees. You can pull out particular efforts, whether they're, you know, managed care and Medicaid or small pockets of individual provider groups trying to do things differently and having something. We tend to know about the excellent examples. The problem is how to broad base them and scale them up. And they tend to have a certain organic nature to it. The same people who were good before are good again. That doesn't necessarily give you the answer to it. I guess the way I look at this is, We with the Affordable Care Act, we increasingly treated the states as the equivalent to like a large employer, self-funded plan. They're for administrative services only and have less of a role in bringing that out. But we also stunted what might have been the more evolutionary bottom-up development of things working and other people saying, hey, that works and you get rewarded if you do it, so let's do more of it. Because we put things into a little bit more of a prefabricated cookie cutter arrangement. And so those examples of great, we overuse the word innovation. I don't want innovation. I want something that works. And if something that works well, it should work on a larger scale and people should do it. That doesn't have to be innovative. It simply has to be better. So it needs to be tested by what results are actually produced. If we get into a more results-oriented approach, which doesn't measure whether you've hit the check marks in the various set of potential healthcare inputs by that measurement, but actually produces better life expectancy or less upsetting consequences to your injuries and improves your health, that's what I want to know about. I also want to know how much it costs. And that's a balancing act between the cost and the outcome side as to which setting you prefer, and they call that value. And as long as we could have more of those choices made at a lower level, not even funneled through states, but actually at the individual or a group, small group level, we'd actually have a more functioning healthcare system where it's results-driven rather than a lot of political rhetoric along the way.
We've been speaking today with Thomas P. Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies health policy and market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. You can learn more about his work by going to aei.org. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
You're very welcome.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Our readers have asked us whether scientists have confirmed that e-cigarettes cause an incurable respiratory disease called popcorn lung. The answer is no. The vapor of some e-cigarettes contains a chemical associated with popcorn lung, but there's not enough evidence to conclude they cause the disease. Electronic cigarettes, or e-cigarettes, were introduced into the U.S. market in 2007. They deliver nicotine, flavorings, and other chemicals to users in the form of a vapor, and they're often promoted as safer than traditional cigarettes. Online articles on e-cigarettes and popcorn lung have been circulating on social media. One story that claimed in its headline that e-cigarettes cause the disease has been shared by Facebook users tens of thousands of times. Popcorn lung, or bronchiolitis obliterans, is an incurable disease characterized by the scarring of the smallest airways in the lung, the bronchioles. That scarring limits the passage of air. If the disease becomes severe enough, the only treatment option may be a lung transplant. Researchers have associated the inhalation of popcorn flavoring chemicals with popcorn lung in workers at microwave popcorn factories. That's where the name of the disease comes from. What does that have to do with e-cigarettes? A December 2015 study conducted by scientists at the Harvard School of Public Health found at least one of three chemicals associated with popcorn lung in 47 of the 51 e-cigarette vapors studied. But the study didn't confirm that e-cigarettes definitely cause popcorn lung. The researchers recommended urgent action to, quote, further evaluate the extent of this new exposure to diacetyl, that's one of the chemicals, and related flavoring compounds in e-cigarettes. Previous research on exposure to diacetyl suggests it might not be that chemical alone that can cause respiratory issues. While it's unclear whether e-cigarettes can cause popcorn lung, what is certain is that they aren't harmless. They contain nicotine, which poses health risks, especially to children and teens. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Fitness trackers have become all the rage, especially among upwardly mobile, fitness-conscious people seeking to monitor their own health and fitness goals. But another trend has emerged in the age of wearable devices. After a few months, about a third of users simply stop using them, leaving a lot of costly devices sitting on the shelf and not in use. The reality captured the imagination of Tufts University School of Medicine professor Dr. Lisa Gualtieri.
And I thought, what if you could take all of these abandoned trackers and give them to the people who could benefit most from them?
So in 2015, she launched her nonprofit enterprise, Recycle Health, an online social media campaign which seeks donated wearable devices to provide these expensive devices for free to those in need.
People are excited about the potential of these devices to help them lead healthier lives. At the same time, there are many, many barriers. So we found a lot of people who never downloaded an app to their smartphone. So how do you get the package, get the device working on your wrist?
She partnered with organizations working with adults in wellness programs, seniors in fall prevention programs, and veterans as well. Her goal is to start collecting vital data on the deployment of these devices and the impact they may be having on behavior change in vulnerable populations.
One of our dreams would be to make it really easy for organizations that have money. So, for instance, insurers to say, the money that we spend on giving people trackers is going to save us so much more than that. in reduced healthcare costs. We're working with a number of senior centers in the greater Boston area. We really see a lot of potential with populations who are not the ones that the vendors are targeting.
She's hoping to expand their data collection on health outcomes for vulnerable populations who gain access to these wearables.
These are devices that people weren't using, people no longer want, and other people are being helped by it. It's about as low cost an intervention as you could possibly have.
Recycle Health, a simple repurposing of personalized wearables, providing these tools to vulnerable populations, empowering them to engage in activities that can improve their own health. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.